The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled The Unpaid Ransom, The Life and Times of Rav Meir of Rothenburg, is dedicated to the merit and honor of the Zeidel and Framer families. Over the past months, we've studied the history of one of Jewry's most glorious literary periods, the era of the Bali Tosfos. Although they suffered greatly from the Crusades, as well as from numerous riots, blood libels, surprisingly, the Jews of Germany were still able to maintain a great measure of independence and wealth, further enabling them to spend their creative energies in their pursuit of the knowledge of Torah. Towards the end of the 13th century, with the ascension to the throne of the Holy Roman Empire by Rudolf I, the founder of the Habsburg royal dynasty, the position of Jews in Germany took a turn for the worse, from which they never fully recovered. The Talmud, the Megillah in 11a, Yud Aleph Amud Aleph, points out the fact that in every difficult period of our history, Hashem has sent us superior individuals who have led in support of the people of their generation throughout their travails and challenges. At the end of the 13th century, the twilight of the glorious period of the Bali Tosfos, Hashem has sent Germany a leader who was head and shoulders above the rest of his generation. Through his commentaries, response, and personal example, he's left all of Jewry with an inspiring legacy. Through his own personal disciples, such as Rabbeinu Osher ben Yechiel, better known as the Rosh, Rav Mordechai ben Hillel, author of the Sefer Mordechai, Rav Meir ben Yekusiel, author of the Agos Maimonis, and many others, he raised a generation of learned scholars and leaders that followed in his footsteps. His name was Rav Meir ben Rav Boruch, known widely as the Maharam Mirutenberg. His story is the subject of this lecture. Rav Meir was born approximately year 1215 into a prominent rabbinic family. As we point out on page 1, Rav Meir's father was a prominent scholar who was quoted by his son and by other authorities. In paragraph A on page 1 is but one example where Mordechai ben Hillel, in his work Mordechai, in the 6th chapter of Bav Metzia, quotes, says, Rabbeinu Boruch, the father of Rabbeinu Meir of Rothenburg, brought the following proof. In other words, he was a scholar of great stature. Paragraph B on page 1 is an excerpt from his epitaph. This is part of his matzeva, his epitaph. To serve as a memory of the saint, a source of blessing, was this tombstone composed. It goes on, the Talmud was fluent in the mouth of Rav Boruch. It goes on further, he supported the members of his generation. His opinions were filled with moral lessons. His lips uttered precious words filled with grace. The fruits of the righteous are the source of life, spreading the spring waters to all the islands, bringing forth precious emeralds and sapphires. Rav Boruch was not the only prominent member of Rav Meir's family. In his responsa, Rav Meir mentions two uncles and 12 other relatives bearing the title Harav, a title reserved for Talmudic scholars. Many of them occupied important positions throughout Germany. He often quoted their legal decisions and opinions and held them in the highest regard. It seems, however, that eventually Rav Meir towered over all of them. This led to a very difficult situation for Rav Meir. The Talmud in Kedushin and Lamed Gimel Amud Beis has the question, we know a son stands up for his father. We also know the disciple, the Talmud, stands up for his master, his Rebbe. What happens when the tables are turned? That one's father is one's own disciple. Or would be in a different situation, even though he's not a direct disciple, but the son is the Godel Hador, is the greatest authority in the generation to whom all seek guidance. In that situation, everyone,
would be required to stand up for the son. He's the God Lador. He's the Rebbe of the generation. What about the father? Is the father required to stand up for his son? Or is the son required to stand up for his father? This was a question that was asked in the Talmud. We quote here from the Rosh in Kedushin. This is in the first chapter. This is Simon. This is paragraph 57. And he says, the scholars propounded, what if his son is his teacher? Must he rise before his father? This is from the Gemara in Kedushin, Lama Gimel Beis in 33b. The Talmud does not resolve the question. The scholars then propounded, what if his son is his teacher? Must his father stand up before him? Now, the first one was, the question was the son rise up before the father? Now, does the father have to rise up in front of the son? Again, the Talmud does not resolve the other question. Because this is an unresolved doubt dealing with a Torah-mandated law, the ruling is that both of them should stand up for each other. It is said regarding Rav Meir of Rotenburg that from the day that he rose to greatness, he never visited his father, nor did he want his father to come to him. He wanted to avoid this question. So he never sought his father. It's an amazing story. Besides for his father, Rav Meir studied under some of the greatest authorities of his generation. At an early age, Rav Meir traveled to Würzburg from his native Worms and studied at the feet of the great Rav Yitzchak of Vienna, the author of the Or Zarua, whom we touched upon in a previous lecture. On page 2, paragraph A, we quote from some of Rav Meir's recollections of that period. Here he brings us a fascinating... I remember the time when I was a mere child studying under, this is Rabbi Yitzchak of Vienna in the city of Würzburg. Now, he evidently came to him when he evidently was a prodigy, and he came to him when he was very young. That a non-Jewish woman came to Rabbi Yosef, the brother of Rabbi Yonason, and told him that his sister had died. If his sister had really died, he would have been required to be in mourning, in other words, to be an oval. But the question is, could he believe this testimony? Is this considered valid testimony for him really to stop everything, you know, and to become? It has a lot of ramifications in his life. Is he required to believe this woman? They asked Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yoel Alevi, the Rav Yo, whom we touched upon again in the previous lecture, for halacha guidance in this matter. And then there's a long discussion in terms of what are the parameters that one is allowed to believe and one is not allowed to believe. This is quoted in the Mordechai in Moed Katan, which deals with the laws of mourning. But just interesting, again, this is a recollection that he had when he was very young, and evidently the Rav Yo was still alive at that time. We know the Rav Yo, it seems, died in the year 1225 or so. So they approximate that he was born in the year 1215, the Ramram Rotenberg. This is so that he would be about 9 or 10 years old. Evidently, he was a prodigy. He came to study again, you know, by this great Talmudic scholar. But it would seem also from the next note, number 2 here, that he stayed some time, because he rose to such prominence that he actually started arguing with his Rebbe and dealing with very difficult laws in terms of marital laws and monetary laws. There's one example here in one of his responses. Some time ago I argued this issue with Butzlik of Vienna. We were together in Würzburg. His opinion that was forbidden, I argued, and he brought him arguments, and he was silent, evidently. He couldn't refute his disciples' arguments. But it would seem that he had already been there for some time and already had gained mastery in much of the Talmud that he could start debating with his Rebbe. In Würzburg, Rav Meir also studied under Rav Shmuel Rav Menachem, which, as we have in paragraph B on page 2. He quotes him here in the Tosfos in Yoma, which was authored by the Maram Rotenberg. He quotes his Rebbe Mer Shmuel Bar Menachem. He also says there's a fascinating halacha, which is quoted by Rav Meir's disciple here, the author of the Tashbatz, Shimshon ben Bar Tzemach, And he says here on the bottom of page 2, Rav Meir said in the name of Shmuel bar Wurzburg, of Wurzburg, the Rabbi Avi Ezri, in other words, this is the Rav Yah, forbade the purchase of shoes on Chol HaMoed. You know, one is not allowed to work on Chol HaMoed. But he forbade purchasing shoes. However, his master did not bring proof that supported that decision. The Maharam actually thought that the idea would be that since in those days, it wasn't like you go to a shoe store and buy shoes. You go to a cobbler. And the cobbler makes actually shoes generally on, I mean, maybe he has extras that he has in stock, but generally he makes measurements to the customer and makes custom-made shoes. So if you went and bought shoes, it at least has the appearance that they were custom-made. And it looked, one perhaps could think, that they were ordered actually for Chol HaMoed, and actually he told the person to actually work on Chol HaMoed. Similarly to the idea that actually they were made before Chol HaMoed, the intermediate days of the holiday, and they were just in the shoe store, but you just wanted to pick them up, and there was no pressing need to use them for the holiday. You just wanted to pick them up. Under normative circumstances, you should wait, because people will think, one of the reasons is, people think, hey, you've picked them up now. I mean, again, these are made to order things, so you must have just finished it, you know, on the, so keep away. And why should you involve yourself in things that people will have mistaken notions? And he wanted to say perhaps this would have been similar, even though the truth is it would seem that shoe cobblers also did have general stock. Besides custom-made shoes, they had general stock. But he finishes at Tashbatz is that the custom of the world is not to be concerned about this. That one could order from, not that which was specifically ordered, but that which was just in stock that one could buy straight from the shelf. But just an interesting that he quotes here from his Rebbe, as I try to do in this lecture series, to bring things which affect day-to-day life. Normally, you're allowed to go to a craftsman to get the things that you order if you need them for the holiday. If you're buying something off the shelf, besides this problem, there's another issue that normally we don't do business on, you know, on Chol HaMoed. The only and we would not buy things. The only exception would be if we could get an exceptionally good price that we could not get it afterwards, where for that savings one would be allowed. So perhaps he's referring to the fact that even when such a substantial savings is a factor, and one would normally be allowed to do it because of the savings, there would be the other factor, but still people may have this mistaken notion. They may think it was custom made and was made specifically on finished on Chol HaMoed, and they'll get the wrong impression, and therefore for that reason you'd be allowed. You shouldn't be. And that would be the question in mind. You should not be, right. But he says the custom is not to follow this, and not to follow this prohibition actually to buy. I mean, this is all in the Tashbatz. Today it's a moot question because we buy, you know, off the shelf. It's very rare that you'll have custom-made shoes. I mean, they exist, but it's far from common. It seems that from Wurzburg, Rav Meir traveled to study under his relative, Rav Yehuda Kohen. Again, in one of the one of his responsa, we bring in the top of page 3, he quotes from him, my relative, my master, Rav Yehuda Kohen, in the Tosfos and Yoma, which he authored. The Maharam Rutenberg says, my master, Rav Yehuda of Metz, of blessed memory, told me. And it would seem to be that this Rav Yehuda of Metz would seem to be the same as Rav Yehuda Kohen, which would tend to think, at least, it's not clear if he lived in Metz, but his city of origin was the city of Metz, which was in the Rhine Valley, which is west of Germany proper. According to Shlomo Lurier, there's a marshal, which we're going to quote further on, Rav Yehuda, his relative, was one of Rav Meir's two most important rebbeim. Even though we know that he studied from Rav Yitzchok of Vienna, Shmuel bar Menachem, it seems this Rav Yehuda had a tremendous impact on his life. For From Germany, Rav Meir traveled to the great yeshiva of Paris to study under the leading Rosh yeshiva of the day, Rav Yechiel of Paris. Although Rav Yechiel is often quoted by Rav Meir, it seems he had very little personal contact with him, as he never quotes that which he directly heard from him, but rather that which others said in his name. And we quote here on page 3 in paragraph D, in his Tosfos on Yoma, Ram Rutenberg says, "I heard in the name of my master, Rav Yechiel of Paris." He didn't say, "I heard directly from him." All the other quotes, interestingly, is, "I heard from him, he said this, he said that." Here's, "I heard others say." It seems, though, that Rav Meir had a much closer contact with a colleague of Rav Yechiel's, and this is Rav Shmuel Bar Shlomo of Falej. And here he quotes from him. We first begin here on paragraph E with a quote from the Marshal Rav Shlomo Luria in his response in number 29. Contemporary with him was Rav Yehuda in Mainz. Evidently, this Rav Yehuda of Metz traveled, had a yeshiva in Mainz, which is on the Rhine. And Rav Shmuel Rav Shlomo, who was called Sur Morel. Rav Meir, may the compassionate guard him, together with all Israel, received his instruction from them. So Marshal mentions these two in particular as being the main influences in Maram Rutenberg's life. And again, in the Tosfos and Yoma, he quotes him directly. V'omar li mori harav Shmuel Rav Shlomo. As my master Rav Shmuel Bar Shlomo told me. Rav Shmuel Bar Shlomo of Falej, together with Rabbeinu Yechiel of Paris, Rabbeinu Moshe of Kusi, and Rav Yehuda ben David of Melun, represented the Jewish community before the court of King Louis IX in their defense of the Talmud in the year 1240. As we explained in a previous lecture, it was to no avail, for on Friday, Erev Shabbos, Parshas Chukas, on June 7th, 1242, 24 cartloads the precious Talmudic manuscripts were burned in Paris by the Dominicans, thousands upon thousands. For many generations afterwards, Erev Shabbos Parshas Chukas was observed as a fast day. The mayor, who apparently was a witness to the events, wrote a stirring lamentation. Shali Srufa Beish is recited to this day every Erev Tisha B'Av. At the bottom of page 3, says, we quote from that moving poem. And again, just let me briefly read an excerpt from the poem. O Torah that has been consumed by fire, seek the welfare of those who mourn over you, of those who yearn to dwell in the courtyard of your habitation, of those who gasp for breath as they lie in the dust of the earth, who are pained and are bewildered over the holocaust of your parchments. They grope in the dark, bereft of light. Indeed, they await daylight that will shine upon them and you. How is it that you, O Torah, given by God, the consuming fire should be consumed by the fire of mortals, that the heathens were not singed by your coals? And it continues on, moreover, O Torah, even decree the burning of your laws and statutes were given by fire. Therefore, fortunate is he who will requite you. Let's take revenge. Soon after that incident of the burning of the Talmud in 1242, Rav Meir returned to Germany and settled in the town of Rothenburg, or was as known in Hebrew, Rutenberg. It was in Rothenburg that the following incident occurred, in which both Rabbi Meir and his respected mentor, Shmuel Bar Shlomo Falej, played a great part. Although we are only aware of the following incident through the responses that were written by various authorities regarding the subject, and don't have a full and independent historic source to give us all of the details, this case makes for fascinating reading and reveals much regarding human nature in general, the personality of Rabbi Meir in particular, and the dynamics of Jewish life in the Middle Ages. The first of the responsa that we're going to quote was written by Rav Shmuel Bar Shlomo of Falej. And here is on the bottom of page 4. Rav Shmuel begins, "My spirit has left me and strength has weakened and I see no light through my eyes. This is due to the oppressor who has exceedingly overpowered us. He has taken from us the soul and treasure of our eyes, the Talmud. We don't have in our hands even one book to give us discernment and understanding. The Almighty should take up the cause of His people and put an end to our suffering. Even though we don't have the exact date when this responsa was written, it would seem that it was written sometime after 1242, the burning of the Talmud, and 1247, when Pope Innocent IV, and I didn't give him his name, urged Louis IX to let the Jews continue the study of the Talmud. And it would seem sometime afterwards that the efforts of the French authorities to totally destroy any remnant, initially when they destroyed all these copies, there were at least a small percentage left, but they kept on going to keep on finding others that had been hidden. In fact, there's one source, and this is a question of interpretation, that some 2 years later after the initial burning, there was another burning in 1244. But after 1247, it would seem that this stopped. So we put this around that period of time. And it continues on. This letter is written in regard to the case of the young man of Rothenburg who betrothed, and the betrother over here means Kedushin, giving the ring, the daughter of Rabbi Yehuda of Duren through a representative. At the time that the match was concluded, the youth's father had agreed that his son was to live with his father-in-law. After the betrothal, the bridegroom came to stay with Rabbi Yehuda, who hired a teacher for him, and the bridegroom stayed with him, was treated with dignity for a long time. A year later, the young man became sick. Rabbi Yehuda, thinking it was a result of the change of climate, sent him home with honor, accompanied by his teacher, and expended large sums of money on his behalf. Subsequently, Rabbi Yehuda sent for the young man to come back and marry his daughter. He, however, was overcome by a different spirit and wished to repay the goodness that was heaped upon him with evil and acted treacherously like a rivulet of a stream. He said, quote, the girl should come to me, to Rothenburg, and I will marry her, end quote. In my opinion, it would seem that he has become wild over the wealth of Rabbi Yehuda and is intending to exact money from Rabbi Yehuda. Therefore, I of humble stature, on condition that my masters agree with my reasoning, would like to make the following argument. And he goes into an extended halachic argument. And he continues on, thus, in our case, it is apparent Rabbi Yehuda did not intend to have his daughter leave him and her mother and be removed from that country of her birth and suffer privation in Rothenburg with her poverty-stricken husband, that he did not intend to spend the large sum of money required to finance the safe conduct of one who was the daughter of a magnate whose name was known throughout the world. Thus, the overlord of Rothenburg, the nobleman, the count who owned the area, acting on the mere rumor that Rabbi Yehuda's daughter was coming to settle in Rothenburg, already sought ways to subjugate Rabbi Yehuda to his will, using his daughter as a hostage. Heaven forbid such a thing. He did not marry her on such a condition. Really, he's alluding really to two things. First of all, it's an undue privation, suffering is not expected of her. And also, the understanding initially by the marriage was that the young man would move to Duren, the place where the girl is. Rather than the girl should go to Rothenburg, where the boy is. Finally, according to the Talmud, this is in Ksubas Kufyudom Abeis 110b, a husband cannot force his wife to move from a humble abode to a more luxurious dwelling. The halos, you can't force a change, since she can make the plausible claim that I'm accustomed in the ways of the wealthy of the land. I was born in poverty. I'm accustomed to that social milieu. And I would feel very awkward in a different kind of a culture. Because of the embarrassment and the awkwardness, you can't force the girl. And there are other plausible reasons in terms of family and politics, that one could make a claim that I would rather not move because of the discomfort level. Most certainly, in this case, if those are factors, then in our case, where she has a well-recognized claims, she's used to wealth. She can't be forced to live in those kinds of conditions of poverty. The husband cannot force her to leave home and travel to Rothenburg. Therefore, the young man should be forced by means of flagellation, as whipping, or the use of the ban of excommunication to marry her or divorce her. This case was brought before us last year, and we decided in the bride's favor. Because of these reasons, I of humble stature have agreed to ban and chastise the bridegroom till he either marries his bride on her terms or divorces her. If he listens, may blessings descend upon him. If he will not, he shall bear his sin, and those that support him shall likewise suffer. None is excluded from our ban, excepting, of course, our honored teacher, Rabbi Meir. Evidently, Rabbi Meir, as we're going to see soon, took the side of the boy, which we're going to see why that is so. But evidently, in those, even though Rabbi Meir was his disciple, was for Shmuel, he treated him with the greatest respect. And he continues on in this responsum. Rabbeinu Gershom requires that a husband be coerced into divorcing his rebellious wife. And as if a wife says, "I want out of the marriage," for whatever reason, she no longer wants to have relations with her husband. She refuses to have relations. Rabbeinu Gershom said that the husband, even though by law he's not required to divorce his wife if she is the one, he says, "Listen, you know, I'm willing to be a husband. It's you're the one who doesn't want to be a wife." He's not required by law. The Beis Din can't force him to divorce. But Rabbeinu Gershom says we do force him, and the grounds are for a different, lest the latter turn to mischief. And if she's not going to have relations with her husband, she refused to have her husband, there's a good chance that she's going to have an affair with somebody else. In order to avoid that, we force the husband to give the get. Although many authorities disagree with Rabbeinu Gershom, and we do not follow his decision, in cases similar to the one at hand, however, we must protect the daughters of Israel, lest unscrupulous young Jewish men use the inability and willingness of daughters of rich men to change their places of residency as a means of extorting the hard-earned money of men's means. May the blessedness of Hashem be upon you, Shmuel Bar Shlomo. This tshuva is in a collection of responsa, which include a great number of Maram Rutenberg's responsa, and this one was included. Before we go on, one thing is clear. I mean, Rav Shmuel Bar Shlomo lived in France. In all probabilities, we're going to see the boy did not go to France in front of the court of this Rav Shmuel. It's the father who made the complaint. The father of the girl who made the complaint sent the complaint, and probably was worded in rabbinic language through the rabbis of Duren to Rav Shmuel, who's considered one of the greatest authorities of the generation. It is weighted very heavily in favor of the father of the bride. The boy comes out looking terrible. He is this wonderful, wonderful man, the father of the girl, who has done everything that he could for this young man, treated him with the greatest of respect. Now that he wants him to fulfill the condition, the only reason we could understand why he does not want to fulfill this condition is really he wants to extort money from his father-in-law. Basically, he doesn't really want to marry the girl. He just wants to put her in a position that this multimillionaire will pay an exorbitant amount of money just to have his daughter get the divorce. That's the picture we have from these facts. This picture is reinforced by the next responsum, also from another contemporary rabbi of France. This is Rabbi Chiel Bar Yaakov Alevi. This is not Rabbi Chiel of Paris, Rabbi Chiel Bar Yosef, but another contemporary authority. On top of page 6, the sound of complaint and wailing about the report of this incident fills the air. Who can remain silent to give up hope when one brother acts treacherously with another, as in the case of Yaakov or of Moshe, who betrothed the daughter of Rabbi Yehuda through a representative on the condition of consummating the marriage in her place of residence. Rabbi Yehuda hired for him a teacher, and his father made return back to his land in order that he be cured of his infirmity. Now Yaakov desires that Rabbi Yehuda send his daughter to him, despite the fact that the roads are dangerous, and this magnate has a name of being great and wealthy and is afraid to send his daughter because of robbers. In addition, he wants him to fulfill the condition that he originally made, that he make his home in Duren and marry her in the place of the original betrothal. In other words, this is what the father of the girl wants. And if not, he should give her a divorce. So these are the two sides. The boy wants the girl to come to Rothenburg. The father of the girl wants him to fulfill the original condition and come to Duren. The law is on the side of the magnate, that he has the right to force the young man to do one of the two options that were previously outlined. In other words, either consummate the marriage or grant a divorce. And it continues on, if one is in violation of the opinion of the rabbis who base themselves upon the teachings of our sages, that the one who betrothed the girl should either marry her or free her, that person should be coerced through chastisement, and there's flogging, or a ban of excommunication. We find many instances where the sages took special measures in order to prevent the possibility of a woman remaining a deserted wife. And he ends, greetings to our rabbis of Germany, unless he was from France. Yechiel Rav Yaakov Alevi. From the Maharam of Rutenberg himself wrote a responsum. In fact, it's a classic. And the principles that he outlines are brought in the Shulchan Aruch Bran Halacha. He disagreed with all of the above. But which is very insightful is that we see the details of this case as they were presented to the rabbis of France and evidently from the father of the bride is very different from the details that Maharam of Rutenberg himself outlines in the following response in the bottom of page 6. We're obliged to try the case of a betrothed woman who demanded that her bridegroom, Yaakov, come to her father's house and marry her there. Yaakov's father, Moshe, representing his son, brought forth the following claim. Quote, after I, Moshe, had committed myself to bring my son there to Duren, I fulfilled that commitment and did so. This was after my son had gone through the betrothal ceremony, the Kedushin, through a representative. At the time of the match, his father-in-law, Rabbi Yehuda, had promised to properly clothe my son and hire a capable teacher for him. After Yaakov had stayed with Rabbi Yehuda for a year's time, he sent him back to me. I don't know what transpired, and he sent no explanation. Seems a little different than the health issue. My son was forced to interrupt his studies, and I was forced to support him with great difficulty for 5 years. This seems a little different from the report that we just had, that he supported him with dignity. I asked many people to intercede on our behalf to ask him to support my son as he had promised. The Maharam continues on, I, the undersigned, you know, Rav Meir of Rothenburg's Maharam, also sent many letters to Rabbi Yehuda. He's saying, I myself sent letters urging him to take pity on his son-in-law who suffered poverty and privation. And it seems all to no avail. He didn't pay any attention to the matter and not send me any reply. Moreover, we have learned through a letter that Rabbi Yehuda does not at all desire the consummation of the marriage, only a divorce, for he was not pleased with Yaakov. This Yaakov was married. He went to this betrothal site unseen, which evidently was not uncommon. You know, there's a Tosfos in Kedushin, Mem Aleph Amud Aleph, in 41a, that comments on a statement of the Talmud that a father really should not betroth his daughter if the daughter is underage. I mean, she doesn't have enough. She is not of sound mind to make a decision for the rest of her life. So Tosfos says, so if that's the case, that's what the Talmud says, why is it that the common custom was not so? That they used to betroth their, give Kedushin to their daughters, and the daughters were minors, and they're making decisions for them, which could be... Which the daughters later on would find fault. And Tosfos' answer is because of the terrible conditions that existed then and the need to provide a dowry, an adan, a nadan for the groom. And if a father has money now, he says, in order to it would to ensure that at least his daughter gets married and does not remain a spinster, for that reason they allow them to do this, to marry their daughters, even though the daughter was not of sufficient age. In this situation over here, this goes one step beyond. Not only, I mean, it was done through a representative, but it seems this the father-in-law, this Rabbi Yehuda, didn't see the boy either. And when he came, evidently he had heard of the boy, and evidently he was a very bright boy. This Yehuda of Durin was a person of great acclaim, so evidently to do a shidduch from a poor boy from Rothenburg, the boy must have had a name of an Elui, you know. He used to have a name of a child prodigy. But there was a sticker shock. When the boy came, evidently, as he saw him, and there were difficulties there. These difficulties we're going to explain a little further on. But at least the story is a little different than it starts off from Rabbi Yehuda's side. Thus, the father of the young man claims, quote, I fulfilled my promise at my son there. He, however, this Rabbi Yehuda, has terribly shamed my son. Even if I would desire the Yaakov go there to Duran, he wouldn't go. Because he was just thrown out. He is also afraid of returning back to live amongst them, because many persons have warned him not to return there, saying, quote, we have heard directly from Yehuda's servants that if Yaakov would go there, Rabbi Yehuda would inflict bodily injury to him unless he would agree to divorce her. Therefore, I feel that my son is not at all allowed to come there to Duran. However, if Rabbi Yehuda sends his daughter here, he will consummate the marriage according to what a Jewish daughter is entitled to by law. End quote. Meir continues on, in addition, the father of the young man gave other reasons why his son cannot go there, be too strenuous to write them all. Our decision is based on irrefutable proofs. And he goes on to say that he feels that this son is not required to go to Duran under these circumstances, consummate the marriage. In fact, he also adds that the condition that he come to Duran and live there was not made by the boy himself, but it was made by the representative on his behalf, unbeknownst to the boy. The boy never agreed to it, and that's he's not bound by that condition. And regarding the principle that a wife's lifestyle, we continue on, I didn't say the whole truth, can only be materially enhanced, and she has the right to demand that it reach the level of her husband's family, but her premarital affluence lifestyle cannot be diminished. In other words, a woman, a woman from a poor family, once she marries a wealthy man, is required by law, the husband has to make her fit into the new family and provide her with all of the amenities that are provided for women of her husband's family. If, on the other hand, she comes from a more aristocratic family, the husband is required to provide her with all the amenities she is used to, or at least the other equivalent women of that family are used to. So her premarital affluent lifestyle cannot be diminished. In this case, it does not apply. This was one of the reasons. How could we let this girl go all the way to Rothenburg and live in abject poverty? Because his father had promised him a large dowry. If he would give him the money, they would live quite well. Without money, he can supply her with food, drink, and clothing like the most prestigious of her family. In this case, he is willing to consummate the marriage in his place of residency. He is not required to follow her to her place. I've deleted some of the arguments. Meir v'Baruch. That's how it is. So we get the story here from Rabbi is a little different than the story as it was presented to the rabbis of France. We get some of the missing details are again filled in with the next response. This was into evidently a colleague of Lezer Rabbi Ephraim. This is on page 7. To my teacher of Meir. Teacher could be a colleague as well. It's just an honorific title. Moshe kept his agreement, this is the father of the boy, and sent his son for Yehuda. When the latter saw that Yaakov was small in stature, homely and despicable, he had pity on his daughter. Fearing lest she begin to despise her bridegroom, he sent Yaakov back to his father to stay there till he grow up. This is a different story than what the father himself presented. When the bride grew up, and Rabbi Yehuda was told that Yaakov also gained strength, he sent for the latter to come and marry his bride. This may be a little different. But thereupon it was decided by Rav Meir that she could not compel Yaakov to move to Duran to force him to divorce her. This decision, however, is very strange. In my opinion, is a perversion of justice for a number of reasons, and he goes on to argue, you know, based on halacha. And he continues on, in the face of these facts, how can, says, rabbi, student, or judge give heed to those who insidiously demand that Rabbi Yehuda's daughter come to live in Rothenburg, knowing full and well that she cannot do so? In other words, the father's not going to let her go. The father doesn't want the marriage. I mean, this person has, from more reliable sources than what the father originally told the rabbis in France, that the father would be willing to go undergo the marriage, not like the report that Mayor Rothenberg heard, that he doesn't want it at all, and when, as soon as the boy comes, they're going to force the boy to divorce. He says they're willing to, at least he has, his version is slightly different. But in any case, he is not going to send his daughter away from him. So what are you doing? You're causing this girl to remain an aguna, to remain a chained woman, because she's not going to, the father's not going to comply. It's obvious these persons who are pressing the case, you know, are only interested in extorting money for Yehuda. It's not becoming your dignity to uphold the cause of these extortionists. Should we allow a Jewish daughter to become deserted with a deserted wife because her father is averse to becoming a victim of extortion? I know that Rabbi Yehuda did not acquiesce. They cannot bear the idea of being coerced and forced to part with his money. You notice that. And that he sent inquiries to the elders, the greatest authorities of France, and to other places. And it was a one-sidedness, that which we have from the rabbis of France was one-sided. The other side was not heard by these rabbis. It was totally from his side. It appears that those authorities have all agreed that Yaakov ought to be forced to marry his bride on her terms or divorce her. Although you are the greatest authority of our generation, you will not find it easy to oppose the decision of our great authorities lest dissensions multiply in Israel. Therefore, he quotes from Proverbs, leave off contention before the quarrel breaks out. By the way, Rav Meir's decision in this case, as we said before, is widely quoted by future generations and is considered authoritative in terms of the details. It is evident from the above that in matters of halacha, Rav Meir himself held himself to be the equivalent of the greatest authorities of France, and he did not retract from his position, at least that there's no record or those who quote him afterwards. It is also evident from the response of Rabbi Eliezer ben Ephraim that Rav Meir was held in the highest esteem. Again, we don't have the full details, but for me myself, looking at this case, it seems to me, at least from Rav Meir's, that this is obvious. Rav Meir looked at Yehuda of Duran, even though he was a great magnate, as a scoundrel. And he felt, because of his wealth, he could do whatever he wanted. And Rav Meir wanted to teach him a lesson. And if that was the case, he knew, that he had enough money that he will come around. And either if he loves his money enough, he will send his daughter to Rothenburg. And if he loves his daughter more, he will give the boy what the boy naturally deserves for all the pain and privation that he experienced because of this man of wealth who thinks that he can just summon the boy and just throw him out and then concoct this whole story to the rabbis of France, how a wonderful, loving person he is, and it was just a problem of a change of climate that he sent the boy back. So just my sense is that Rav Meir used his discretion here knowing full and well, based on his arguments, that Halacha did not force the boy to divorce, that that his position was the correct one in this. And the whole thing, this Rabbi Yehuda, is a thing that it's a problem of extortion. He didn't look at it as extortion. It was really it was just a matter of righting the wrong, and that people of wealth should not consider that they own the world and can do whatever they want to people that are poorer than they. To get a better understanding of how Rabbi Meir was held in the eyes of his contemporaries, as well as in the eyes of the greatest Talmudic authorities of later generations, please turn to page 8. And here we quote from the Tshuvos Maralbach. Maralbach was the chief rabbi. He was the chief rabbi of Jerusalem in the 16th century. And he quote, referring to the author of the Hagos Maimonis, Meir ben Yekusiel, Mordechai, the author of the Sefer Mordechai, Mordechai ben Hillel, and the Rosh, he says, all three of them were disciples of Aram of Rutenberg, who considered to have been the supreme halachic authority of all of Ashkenaz, due to his immense wisdom and the fact that he was the last great authority in the period of the Bali Tosfos. The Rajba, who was a contemporary of the Aram of Rutenberg, a younger contemporary, says, how can I reverse the decision this Meir made? For Meir is an elder who sat in the Academy of Talmudic Study, a wise and elderly man who has ruled upon the issue. Even though I personally feel he is not correct, how can I reverse his decision? Shlomo Luria, in his preface to the Yamshel Shlomo to Bava Kamma, refers to him as he was a humble and pure man, and none of the later authorities were of comparable stature. He was known as the Maram of Rothenburg. He established one disciple who was his successor and almost as great as he. This is our master and teacher, Rabbi Osher, was instructed well by him. They expounded and investigated and built their foundations upon the words of Rabbeinu Alfasi, who clarified the Talmud and sifted through it carefully. Together they brought to light all that was hidden in the words of the Tosfos. On page 9, in paragraph D, we get a sense in the conditions in which the mayor of Rutenberg lived. This is referring to mezuzos, really, how many mezuzos you put into a house. He says, in our house, I believe there was approximately 24 mezuzos. I put a mezuzah for the Beis Medrash, and there's evidently in the house there was a Beis Medrash, a study hall was part of his house. For my winter heating room, at the entrance to the house, at the gateway of the courtyard, which is open to the street, for the covered attic, which I use as a dining room in the summer, as well as for the individual rooms for the young men of the yeshiva. Evidently, his home housed his own personal residence as well as the yeshiva and dormitory facilities. They not only lived in his house, but it seems his relationship to him was very close. This is in paragraph E, we quote from the Hagos Maimonis, Hilchos Talmud Torah, where I saw my master, Rabbeinu Meir, display honor to his students, even to those who were not very distinguished. His concerns were not only focused upon his students. Questions were sent to him from throughout Germany, Austria, Bohemia, as well as from France and even Spain. To give you a sense of the volume of his responsa, please read together with me in paragraph F and G. It is in paragraph F, he brings from one of his responsa, because I am forced to write so many bundlefuls of response to all the surrounding areas, I cannot find sufficient time to address you in writing in a manner that I really feel is appropriate for a man of your stature. And there's, he did not, the preface, which would normally be full of great laudatory praises, were deleted because I have a pile of correspondence. And in another one, he says, my master should please forgive me if I did not write in a manner which is befitting a person of your stature, for I did not have time. Presently I'll respond to you in brief. Marama's impact was not only felt in scholarly or legal circles. Much of the way we conduct daily life has been affected by the legal decisions and customs of Rabbi Meir. While he was in prison, a period which we'll soon elaborate upon, his devoted disciple, Rav Shimshon Bar Tzadok, faithfully recorded his opinions, rituals, and customs in his work Tashbatz. The name is an acronym for Teshuvas, Rav Shimshon Bar Tzadok. Later works such as Sefer Aguda, Kolbo, copied Rav Meir's Hanhogas, his customs and rituals, which led them to be incorporated into later codes, especially the Darkei Moshe of Rav Moshe Israelis, which eventually became part of the greater Shulchan Aruch, the standard code of Jewish law. On page 10, we give several examples. Since we take them for granted, it would be very instructive to go through the sampling of Rav Meir's rulings and customs. He says, he starts off, Maram, this is Maram of Rutenberg, Rav Meir, would always wash his hands after making Kiddush. There's an argument amongst Germans, they usually wash their hands first and then make Kiddush afterwards. And after the Kiddush, they make Hamotzi. Maram would do the opposite, which is the most common Ashkenazi custom. Even on Shabbos day and in Yom Tov, he would wash after making the blessing of Borei Pri HaGofen, even though there's no great gap, and as all you say is Borei Pri HaGofen, just making a small profit. He maintained that the mixing of pouring the wine was considered an interruption, and he'd first make the Kiddush and then wash his hands. And this is, again, common custom. Paragraph B, Maram, a blessed memory, would not make the blessings of Al Netilas Yadayim when he washed his hands before the eating of karpas, the vegetable that we eat on the Pesach Seder, and this is when he made Borei Pri Adoma. But he would wash without making a blessing. This, again, is the most common custom. According to the Vilna Gaon, one should make a blessing. There are other Rishonim who maintained that one should make a bracha when one washes his hands before the karpas, the vegetable. Common custom is not based on Maram of Rutenberg. We take the common customs to take three matzahs by the Seder. There are other opinions, and this is including the Vilna Gaon, only to take two matzahs. Referring to Rav Meir of Rutenberg, heard from the mouth of Rabbi Yitzchak of Vienna, who stated the name of Rabbi Shmuel. It's not clear who this is. Is this Rabbi Shmuel Bar Menachem? Is this Rabbi Shmuel HaChosid, the father of Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid? That the reason that we have three matzahs on the Seder night is based upon the fact that one is required to express his thanks for being freed from prison by bringing a thanksgiving offering, which consists of four types of bread, besides the animal that is sacrificed. These consist of three kinds of matzahs and one of chometz. One of each variety is given to the Kohen. This is the, when you bring a thanksgiving offering, there are three varieties of matzahs. There are 10 loaves of each, and one of them is given to the Kohen. On the Seder night, we commemorate our release from being prisoners in Egypt, and we take three matzah breads, is the number being, they're not three types, but just as a reminder. Therefore, if three matzahs is a symbolic remembrance of the Thanksgiving offering. Rabbeinu Avi Ezri explained that we break the middle matzah and guard half of it to be used as the afikoman, which is again the common custom. We break the middle matzah, that's sofron, and we leave it for the afikoman. The Tashbatz also brings, we were allowed to put on tefillin on Tisha B'Av, however, Rav Meir did not put them on in the morning, again, which is the common custom. Tefillin is not put on the morning of Tisha B'Av, only the afternoon. Again, based on Maram Rutenberg. So just as much of what we do in life, he's had like a tremendous impact. Paragraph E here on page 11, Rav Meir pronounced the blessing of Shechiyonah on both days of Rosh Hashanah prior to the blowing of the shofar, as well as on both nights when making Kiddush. However, he would customarily delay drinking wine from the new crop until the second night of Rosh Hashanah, when he would then drink the wine and make the blessing of Shechiyonah. This was done in order to avoid becoming involved in controversy, as there were great authorities who maintained that one should not make the blessing of Shechiyonu on the second day. Now, there's a question. However, the new wine was not available, we would still recite the blessing of Shechiyonu. That is the source of our custom, that we have a new fruit on the table on the second night of Rosh Hashanah. There's a question, should you make a Shechiyonu the second night or not? Because Rosh Hashanah is a little different than the other two-day holidays. And because of that, we don't have new wine, but we at least have some new fruit, and we make the Shechianu. We say the Shechianu, but just in case we don't have to, we make it on the new fruit as well. Maram, on paragraph F, Maram would always recite Hashem Svosai Tiftach before the Tefillah of Shachris and before Ma'ariv. He would not recite, however, Ki Shem Hashem Ekra on these occasions. This he only did before Musaf and Mincha. It was because it's not mandated in the Talmud. And again, this is common custom. In G, it was the custom of Aram, blessed memory, to eat the head of a ram on the first night of Rosh Hashanah as a remembrance for the ram of Yitzchak. The Talmud does not mention it. The source is the Aram of Rittenberg. People afterwards have gotten a little thing and they just eat the head of a fish. But the head of the ram is, you know, has the dual thing. It's the head and also the ram remembering the Akedah, which is a major theme of Rosh Hashanah. On H, we have page 12, top, Maram, blessed him, would recite the entire first blessing of the Amida, but he was a chazan. He would be the shlich tzibur until Laman Shmo Biava. He would then begin Misod HaChachomim. In other words, he would begin what would be the piyutim, the yotzros of the Shmon Esrei for Shachris. He would say Zochreinu Lichayim with a shva sound, the is sound, because Lachayim with a patach has the connotation of meaning la as low, as no, as you find the tractate in the Dorim. As you find the idea that that sometimes the word la could, in Aramaic, and how was it, was la could mean low. So we don't want to have in anything that it means. So we say Zochreinu Lichayim, the Melech Chofetz Ba'chayim. Then when we have the Ba, the in, where there's no room for error, then we say the life, the ultimate life. We would have wanted to say Lachayim also. In other words, it says Zochreinu Lach for the life, the ultimate life. But we don't. We say the shvo sound, the I, instead of the ah, because of the room for error. Yeah, based on the Maram. In paragraph I, on the eve of Yom Kippur, before he recite Yom Kol Nidre, begin with the refrain, V'yeshiva Shomailo, V'yeshiva Shomata. That's the refrain that. And then finally, in this section, on paragraph K, he would fast every year on the day of the yahrzeit of his father and mother. He also said Kaddish for his mother in his father's lifetime. He continues on, if the father would object, he would not say it. Well, didn't object, but he would say this. Again, this is the source of his hanhugas, how it became common custom. And by the fact, he says he would do this, not everyone did this. But what he did became common amongst Jewry. I would just like to end off this section with a response of Reb Meir's that deals with the extremely important question about living in Eretz Yisrael. Regarding the question you asked about the essential mitzvah of moving to Eretz Yisrael, I only know that which is explicitly stated at the end of the tractate Ksubos about the importance of living in Israel. Regarding the question of if his sins are forgiven if he moves to Eretz Yisrael, this is also explicitly stated in the tractate Ksubos. But the person must remove himself from sin from that time onward. He should be, in other words, it isn't the fact that you live in Israel, you're automatically forgiven. If you make that move, it's a new start. And you're in Israel, Hashem will say, okay, this is a new beginning. But from that time on, you have to be a tzaddik. He should be extremely careful from committing any sin and fulfilling all the mitzvahs that are applicable. For if he sins over there, the punishment is much greater than if he sins outside of Eretz Yisrael. This is because Eretz Yisrael is the land that Hashem constantly monitors, where the eyes and attention of Hashem are perpetually directed. One cannot compare an act of rebellion in the palace of the king to a comparable act outside the palace. And it continues on, even the non-Jews of Eretz Yisrael suffer because how they sin there. However, if a person goes there for the sake of heaven to live in sanctity and purity, there's no end to his reward he must have, though the means to support himself. But here, evidently, for people who are tzaddikim, he is very for the idea of moving to Israel, but only if you're going to be a tzaddik. If there's one incident that boldly stands out in the life of a mayor of Rothenburg, it is the astonishing story of the unpaid ransom. This story has already been fully embellished 150 years ago by Rabbi Dr. Marcus Lehman in a novel by that name, as well as by subsequent authors. The story itself, as is presented from historical sources, however, is very problematic and leaves us with some very important unanswered questions. For the most part, the approach that I am taking to these questions, at least in the beginning of this, was originally presented by Dr. Irving Agus in his brilliantly researched work on the life and response of Mayor of Rothenburg. Let us first read together the source material. The first source, A, is taken from the official records, the Pinkus of the community of Worms. Reb Meir of Rothenburg, the son of Reb Boruch, was set out to go across the sea together with his family, his daughters, and his sons-in-law. He came to a town situated in the mountainous region called Lombardisch Gebirge. Those are the mountains of Lombardy. Lombardy is in northern Italy, where he intended to wait for his fellow travelers who were to join him on the journey. The Bishop of Basel, however, on his way from Rome, rode through the town in the company of a man who was an apostate named Kneppe, who recognized Reb Meir and informed the bishop. The bishop brought about the arrest of Reb Meir through the ruler of that town, Count Meinhard of Giertz, on the 4th of Tammuz, 5046, and it was June 28th, 1286. Count Meinhard delivered Reb Meir to King Rudolf, who kept him in prison till the day of his death on the 19th of Iyar, 5053. April 27th, 1293. He was in prison for almost 7 years. He was not buried, however, until a generous spirit was aroused in the heart of the philanthropist Reb Ziskin Wimpin of the city of Frankfurt. He gave an enormous sum of money in order that Reb Meir be brought to burial in the burial place of his fathers in the city of Worms. That philanthropist died shortly afterwards and acquired the plot adjacent to his. At this point, we have to ask ourselves, first, why did Reb Meir leave Germany? Evidently, he was not alone as he was waiting for fellow travelers. Second, where was he planning on going? The text reads across the sea. Was he planning to go to Eretz Yisrael? It's not clear from the text. Again, we have no hint. Also, why was he arrested? It would seem that he did something that would warrant arrest, either back home in Rothenburg or by merely fleeing. Keep these questions in mind as we continue. The second source we quote is from the historic record kept by the Dominican monks in the city of Colmar in northeastern France, which in the 13th century is part of the Holy Roman Empire of Rudolf I. And here, paragraph B, this is written in Latin, we translate, King Rudolf sees the Jew from Rothenburg, whom the Jews thought to be outstanding in many facets of knowledge, and amongst them he was considered great in wisdom and honor. In the Latin, the name of the city given is Rotwilre, which, as Dr. Agus points out, must be Rothenburg. The date of the capture is given for 1287. Which would seem to indicate, if we assume that the scribe himself was not in error, that Reb Meir was transferred to Germany itself from Lombardy. This is in the year 1287, at least a half a year, if not much longer. Because this is June. It would also seem that the very first place of Germanic detention we find mentioned is Waschburg, or Wasserburg, which is on the top of page 14. Which is an amazing story that Hagos Maimony brings. I recall the following incident when I was in the Tower of Wasserburg. It was Erev Shabbos. We made a bonfire. to warm ourselves up at night. As we were sitting down and the fire was almost out, the servants of the lord of the castle unexpectedly came in and made the fire bigger. They clearly said they were doing it in order that we have pleasure. We all sat together and were delighted that this had happened. We had quoted in a previous lecture that Yaakov of Orleans had ruled that one is allowed to have a non-Jew light the fire because we are considered sick, sickly in terms of being deprived of heat. And this most certainly would be the case if it would be in a castle tower and a man who was in his 70s. As you remember, Rittenberg was born in the year 1215. This is 1287. He's 72. And we find that from the next quote as well, we find that he was imprisoned again in this tower of Wasserburg. If you notice the next in paragraph 2. It seems, however, that the bulk of the time of his imprisonment was spent in another prison or castle, and this was in Ensenschein. Here we quote on number 3 on page 14 here. My master of mayor agreed to all of the aforementioned, that one has the entire 3 hours a day to recite Kriya Shema. This is in the Hagos Maimonides, about that one is allowed to say the Shema the first 3 hours of the day. There was an opinion quoted that it means just till the beginning of the third hour, where the mayor took issue with it, no, all 3 hours. And he agreed he expressed his opinion of the all 3 hours, and it was in the Tower of Ensenschein. In other words, while the Hagos Maimoni was there visiting his disciple, the Hagos Maimoni was there visiting his Rebbe, Ram Rutenberg, Ram made that statement. It seems also that the bulk of the time that he spent was in this place, Ensisheim. Ensisheim is in Alsace, which is in eastern France. But that time was part of Germany. Now let us read from the writings of Shlomo Luria, known as the Marshal, one of the leading Talmudic scholars of the 16th century, the major historic source that we often quote in this series. This quote is taken from his work Yom Shel Shlomo on the tractate Gittin. And this is the bottom of page 14. I heard a report about Maram of Rothenburg, of blessed memory, that he was imprisoned in the Tower of Ensisheim for many years. The overlord demanded from the communities a large sum, and the communities were willing to redeem him. He did not let them do so. This is part of the report. The Marshal in other areas quotes written documents. This here he's quoting a report. A report, you know, which occurred some 300 years after the fact. One is not allowed to redeem captives of more than their normative price. That's what the report says. In other words, he wants an exorbitant amount, the overlord, and you can't pay him the amount. Now the Marshal speaking, he says, I wondered about this report. Since Rameir was an extraordinary scholar, there was no one in the generation that could compare with him in his knowledge of Torah and piety. One is allowed to redeem such a person for all the money in the world. If the reason he felt that he was unworthy of being considered of such status was because of his great humility, he should have still been concerned about remaining in prison because of his inability to study. As he himself wrote, when he was sitting in darkness in the shadow of death without Torah and light, he would bemoan the fact that he did not have with him the works of the halachic authorities or Tosfos. How could he not be concerned about the sin of the cessation of Torah study, since the community at large needed him? It must be that he was of the opinion that if they redeemed him, there was a real fear that all of the nobility would follow suit and imprison the most prestigious Torah authorities of their generation in order to extract an exorbitant sum of money. This would cause an impossible burden on world Jewry. The result of all of this would be that Torah would be forgotten from Israel, as their greatest authorities would be languishing in prison. Because of this concern, this devout saint said that it would be better that a small amount of wisdom be lost from Israel now than the entirety of the wisdom of Torah be lost forever in the future. The indication that this theory is correct is after this incident, no other Torah scholars were ever imprisoned for ransom. This is the Marshal. The Marshal is basing himself, of course, on the report. And what he's trying to do is to find basis for the report. Because the report basically says the Jewish community wanted to redeem him, Maram of Rutenberg refused. His question was, how could he refuse this? And the answer is because of a policy. It was a policy issue that he was afraid it would start with him and it would go on to others. This theory is widely quoted, is assumed by historians that came after the Marshal. In almost every account you'll find of the Maram of Rutenberg, this is the reasoning that is given. However, as Dr. Agus points out, there are several difficulties with this theory, with the report and with the theory. First of all, is that Rabbeinu Osher, the Rosh, the Maram's most prestigious disciple, in his elucidation of the halachas governing the redemption of captives and the length that one is required to go in order to redeem a scholar, makes no mention of an exception in a situation similar to that of the Maram. As if this is an important policy, because he mentions the Rosh, that for a Torah scholar, you redeem for any a true scholar for all the money in the world. The halacha that said that one is not allowed to redeem captives and more than the basic price, the normative price, was on for regular people. But for a scholar that the community needs, the whole future of Jewry is dependent on, so there are no monetary limits. He should have at that point said the exception. When you're fearful that this is the beginning of a pattern, and he has historic precedent, but he makes no mention of this. In general, when the Maram of Rutenberg expressed an opinion, even an opinion which the Rosh later took issue, the Rosh would quote him. Why, if this report is true and the Marshal's reasoning is true, why is it that the Rosh does not say this? It's a ha'ora, it's a point. We have other problems here. As we quote, the Seder Adoros, quoting from the Shalshelis HaKabbalah, on page 15, telling over the story of the imprisonment of Maram of Rutenberg, says, Maram died in prison because the king had brought false claims against him as a result of a certain incident. He doesn't say what the incident, nor does he say what the claims were. He asked a tremendous sum in order to allow his release. The Rav was poor himself, and the king did not want any other Jew to be a guarantor for this sum other than Rabbeinu Osher, his disciple. As an act of compassion for his master, he willfully became his guarantor. In other words, he would make sure that the monies would be raised. At that point, they transferred Rabmeir to a much better prison, which would mean, it seemed to be, they transferred him from this Wasserburg to Enzeshan, while they were waiting for the entire amount to be paid. In the middle of all of this, Maram died in prison. It would seem from this that there was no refusal from the Maram's part. Rabbeinu Osher fled and sent his son ahead of him to prepare for him a place in Toledo. Even though much of what the Shalshelis HaKabbalah writes is suspect, as we've pointed out, because he indiscriminately quoted from various sources. However, in this particular instance, the source that he bases himself is really an eyewitness to this event. This Rabbi Yehuda, the son of the Rosh, describes these events in his last will and testament that he wrote to his own children. And he writes here on the top of page 16, the reason that my master, my father, the Rosh of blessed memory, left Germany was related to the imprisonment of Rabbeinu Meir of Rothenburg. When the ruler of Germany had Rabbeinu imprisoned and the communities of Germany were willing to pay a tremendous sum to have him redeemed, the only guarantor for that amount that the ruler was willing to accept was my master, my father, of blessed memory. Before the collection of the monies were divided amongst the communities, Rabbeinu passed away while still in prison. This is the 19th of Iyar, 1293. The ruler falsely libeled my master, my father, blessed memory, saying that since Reb Meir died in prison, before he was freed, my father was still under obligation, that he and the communities are still required to pay the money for his release. My father removed himself from the king's presence and went to a different city. Because of his fear of the government, he left Germany. Also, finally, on page 16 in paragraph G, We have a letter from the Aram himself. He says, when I leave prison in peace, I will make the effort to make sure that my commentaries on Zeroyim and Tyrus, the orders dealing with agriculture and ritual purity, will be copied for you. I have not forgotten my Creator, my imprisonment, and in His Torah and awe have I clung. The generous one should see the pleasantness of Hashem. The shine of the most precious gold shall not dim, which seems to be a reference that the monies should be collected. He was waiting for the monies to be collected. So if that's the case, so why wasn't he redeemed sooner? I mean, it is, you know, it's still some years from 1280. He, you know, still some years, you know, till his death. There was a 7 years, you know, from 86. Okay, so 87 he got to Germany, but 6 years. What happened? Why did he leave? We know from other sources. The Jews in 1286, at least, were fleeing en masse from Germany. There's a... We have records. An official letter was sent to the authorities and burghers of the cities of Mainz, Speyer, Worms, Oppenheim, and the towns of Wetterau. In it, the Rudolf stated that since a number of the Jewish residents of these cities had fled beyond the sea, again, without receiving the king's permission, it was fitting and proper that the king appropriate the property that they had left behind. The king appointed the Archbishop of Mainz and Count Eberhard of Katzenelnbogen. That's the source of that name, by the way. Katzenelnbogen was a city. To take over and manage these properties. Even though we have no exact figures how many Jews fled, you know, this is the... But it seems that there were quite a few. It must have been considerable if the king took such an unprecedented measures, as he appointed people of high stature to take over the properties. From one source, we do learn that the burghers of Mainz appropriated 54 houses that belonged to the Jews who left that year. We don't know how many Jews lived in it, but we would assume, even if there would be 10 in a town, that's 550 Jews. That's a lot of people. And there weren't that many Jews in these cities. A lot of Jews fled. Some historians have theorized that the reason they left was the terrible conditions. Blood libels, massacres. In Mainz, there was a blood libel, says in 1283, and 10 Jews were massacred. On the same day, 26 Jews were massacred in Bachrach. A few days later, 16 Jews were killed in the city of Bruckenhausen. 2.5 years later, this was in April of 1283, 2.5 years later, it was in 1285, as a result of a blood accusation, 180 Jews were burned to death in a synagogue in Munich. But incidents like these were not uncommon to Jews. I mean, we quote over here, you know, in paragraph H in the 16, where through the years there were terrible conditions for Jews. And yet all those years they seem to have remained in Germany. What changed? So Dr. Agus suggests that the Jews were in the midst of a struggle for rights. As we quote here on page 17, and this is from a Tosfos in Bava Kamma 58a, Jews always had the right of domicile. They could live wherever they want. And they felt, the Jews, that if any overlord forbade them from leaving or confiscated their property because they left their particular area or region, he was not, the overlord was acting as a robber. He was not acting within the within his legal rights. He says the right of every Jew is to live wherever he wants. You have to pay taxes where you are, but you can leave. We are not the slaves of anyone. The Maharam himself, dealing with a rule made by the king, says the king has limited rights and cannot hold. There's a question of holding one Jew security for another that a Jew doesn't, you know, appears in court, and if not, I will fine all the Jews. He says you don't have to pay such a fine. King Rudolf at that time, though, was promulgating a doctrine which the kings of England had already promulgated years before, which we discussed in the previous lecture, on the top of page 18. So everyone, especially the Jews, inasmuch as they are servants to our chamber, since it is seen that all persons and their possessions pertain to us. They maintain the Jews and their possessions belong to the king. Therefore, they can do, he has the right to tax them or do anything he wants to them. I mean, we've seen, we spoke the last lecture, that Aaron of Lincoln, who was the wealthiest man of England, and this is in the late 1100s, when he died, the king, this is Henry, confiscated everything that he had. And later on, this is King John of England, made the Jews almost penniless because of all the additional taxes he placed. Up until then, though, they felt the right of a king was limited. Rudolf felt that the king has the right to assume greater powers than had previously been assumed. And he had a problem. He needed money. Jews were a wonderful source of money. The Jews were already being paid fully, either to the towns or to the overlords. And he wanted to have a new source of taxes. The Jews refused to pay the taxes. And it was really because of this. We find here in the Tshuva of Maharam, here on page 18, tax has to be paid on property even though the owner's left. However, poll tax and income tax are not to be paid if the person does not live in the area under the authority of the overlords. The Jews are not serfs to be considered chattel wherever they are. We view the Jews as free men who have fallen on hard times and not as those who have been sold into slavery. In the midst of all of this, this dynamics, Professor Agus claimed that it was because as a means of protest that when the king wanted to start indiscriminately tax the Jews, that the Maharam was involved in this movement, the Jews should protest by leaving. And for that reason, he encouraged, this is his theory, that the Jews should leave. We know Jews left at the time. And he encouraged, and he himself was part of the protest movement. It was because of this reason that the Maharam was imprisoned. According to this, he understands, he wants to put the report of the Marshal, not the Marshal's explanation, but at least that report that the Maharam refused, together with this, with the other reports that we have, the other documented sources, that the Maharam actually wanted to be released. And he says, initially, Maharam wanted to be released. The king assented to this. When the money started being collected, the king reneged on his promise and said, oh, those monies, those isn't for this ransom. These are for taxes that you owe me that you refuse to pay. And therefore, says when the king says, when you pay all of this, then we'll start with new monies for the ransom of the Maharam. This is his theory, Dr. Agus says. At that point, the Maharam says, listen here. He says, this is not right. If they're going to take the money for the ransom, and he's going to claim it's tax money, and now they're going to take this new money for the ransom, what I'm doing is supporting the role of the king, the right to take all these extra taxes. And what I'm doing is I'm making miserable the lives of the Jews, because it's not just a question of this ransom money, but all future taxes. My refusal to take the ransom is a statement against all these taxes. This is how Dr. Agus understands. And we find here, it goes on page 19, this is a tshuva of Chaim Reb Yechiel, possibly the brother of the Rush, who, speaking to the king, and you could read this yourself, time doesn't allow, he said, we are under no obligation to you. This is how he spoke to the king. If you fulfill your solemn promise to us, you shall be paid. Even I shall endeavor to persuade the community of Cologne to pay its share. Otherwise, you will not receive even a penny. From this, it would seem that he was speaking to him, you absolutely have no right to collect any monies from us, only for the ransom, and only if you make good on your promise to release Maharam. Otherwise, we're not going to pay you. So Dr. Agus puts in this whole framework that monies were collected, and once they were collected, he said, aha, that's for past taxes. Now I want the new money for the ransom. There are many difficulties with this. There's no hint of two monies in any of the sources. From the Shalshelis HaKabbalah, from the son of the Rosh, there's just one amount of money that wasn't collected. It would seem to me that I'm not sure, again, this is what the reason Maram left. It's doubtful. I personally doubt that it was because to make a political protest, as Dr. Agus says, is because it's really not in keeping. Gedolim generally don't, leaders of generations don't forsake their communities. They don't make political statements. Others do, they don't. The people need a shepherd. Perhaps because of all the difficulties. He was 72 already, or 71. He was complaining of the amount he was overworked with responsa. He felt he would give the generation over to younger people. He had great disciples, and it was time for him to move to Eretz Yisrael. We see how much he loved Israel. And the other response, as long as you have the money to live there, he felt you should live there. And quite possible that's why he went. I mean, again, we don't know where the sparsity of it. It would seem also to me that it wasn't a question that he refused to be released. It seemed to me from the other documentation, the report was not correct. They began to collect the monies. Initially, the king said he would release them if they at least made a down payment. On that, the king reneged. And all he did was just transfer the Maram to better conditions, but he did not actually release him, and said, when you give me all the money, then I will release him. At that point, it was very hard for the Rush to raise the monies. Evidently, he initially had stated that he would release them immediately. And he reneged. Now he changed, well, as soon as you give me all the monies, and people were reluctant. It took him a while. In the middle, he says, actually, we don't know when he would transfer to Germany, in 1287. We know Rudolf died in 1291, 2 years before the Maram of Württemberg died. At that point, a civil war broke out that lasted some 7 years. At that point, there's a civil war. There's no one to talk to. So really, we're dealing with only some 3 years or so, of 3.5 years of collecting monies, until all the negotiations went through, until everything went through. It seems to me that what happened was the Maram expected to be released. He was miserable in prison. He writes thing about how terrible it is. If you know, in the bottom of page 19, he's terribly depressed. And he wanted to be released. And but it was till many years until it finally was released. And just, it's the story here, to conclude over here, the story of Maram, is with the, on page 20 here. I, the writer, this is the author of the Seder Hadoros, found the following in an old collection. In the year 5046, 1286, the king of Rome, who was called Adolf, this is Rudolf the First, imprisoned Rabbeinu Meir. He died in prison on 19th day of the month of Iyar in the year 5053, 1293. He was not allowed to be buried until the month of Adar in the year 5067, 1307. Can you imagine what these kings were? He says, if I don't get the ransom, I'm not burying. Again, it's not clear what infraction he did. And maybe it was, maybe he did encourage people to leave. It's just not clear. There is a tradition that these were the names of the overlords who imprisoned him. This is Markareth, maybe it's Meinhardt, Ulreich, Jorg, and Rudolf. And as he went from one to the other, perhaps these Ulreich and Jorg were the overlords in Wasserburg and Ensesheim. Spelling out the acronym Mayer. I also heard that the following, from an elderly scholar, heard this from reliable sources. A certain man of wealth risked his life in order to bring Rabbi Mayer to burial. Immediately after the burial, Rabbi Mayer came to him in a dream and told him, choose one of two things. Either you and all of your posterity for all time will merit a long life with wealth and honor. You will immediately die and merit the world to come. He chose to immediately die, and that is what exactly happened. Immediately upon arising, he took ill. Then he made his last will and testament to his family, then died. That man came in a dream to the rabbi of the city and told him that the promise was fulfilled, that he was placed in the other world in the circumscribed area of Rabbi Meir. The wealthy man who brought Rabbi Meir to burial was Alexander ben Shlomo. This is Alexander Ziskin. This is Ben Shlomo Wimpin.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.